The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Standifer against the United States. Proceed whenever you are ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the opinion in U.S. versus Standifer appealed from is now reported at 610 Federal 2nd, 1076. It had not been when we prepared our briefs.
What was the page, 76?
1076, Your Honor. 610 Federal 2nd, 1076. In this case, Mr. Standifer was indicted in a 9-count indictment, the odd counts of which charged him with violation of 26 U.S.C.A. 7214A2, the even counts of which charged 18 U.S.C. 201F. Having read the 72-page opinion, majority and minority opinions of the Court and Bank, and the three-judge panel of the Circuit Court withdrew their original opinion when they did order a hearing before the Court and Bank. But in reviewing that and in reviewing the briefs in this case, sort of reminds me a little bit of the Alice in Wonderland story when Alice says to the big rabbit, "Where do I start?" And the rabbit said, "You start at the beginning, you proceed to the end, and then stop." Now, in this case, as a defense lawyer and trial counsel in the court below, when I received the indictment and the privilege of representing Mr. Standifer, I didn't start with the legislative history in 1908, which was 5 years before the 16th Amendment, which allowed income tax laws to be passed to create the bureaucracy that they now want to apply the legislative history of 1908 to.
Well, Mr. Gondelman, after having read your 113-page brief on the petition for writ of certiorari, I noticed that nowhere do you cite Dunn against the United States, which is Justice Holmes' old opinion saying that inconsistent verdicts and juries are perfectly permissible under the Constitution, under the federal law. Do you think you can win this case without overruling the Dunn case?
I think so, Your Honor, and I'll address myself directly to that. Because in order to start in this case, you must start by reading the indictment against Mr. Standifer. And unfortunately, no court has yet got to the indictment that I thought I was trying. Let me show Your Honor why I think and did not discuss Justice Holmes' case, because it has nothing to do with this case, if I may say so. The indictment in this case says that Mr. Standifer did on or about, and I won't go through all nine, the odd counts, but they each start with a date, did aid and abet Cyril J. Niederberger, an officer and employee of the United States acting in connection with revenue laws of the United States, namely a supervisory internal revenue agent, skipping dates, in unlawfully and knowingly receiving a fee, compensation, and reward as set forth below, which was not prescribed by law for the performance of his duties as an Internal Revenue Service agent. Now, when I read that indictment, I then, to make certain that all courts would be able to correlate very clearly what I am talking about, in my motion to dismiss, I attached the count one indictment against Standifer with the count two indictment against Niederberger so that we could see exactly what the same party, that is the United States of America, under its grand jury, charged Mr. Niederberger with, as well as Mr. Stanifer with. And at pages 28A on, you will see that the grand jury indictment against Mr. Niederberger says that from on or about the same dates as Stanifer is charged with having given the fee compensation reward to an officer employee, Niederberger, no one else, Niederberger, that Mr. Niederberger did receive the golf trip in the exact amount on the exact date to the same place at the same time.
Well, what if Mr. Niederberger had dropped dead even before he was indicted? Do you think that would preclude an indictment and conviction of Stanifer?
Mr. Chief Justice, we're long past the need to try the principal or convict the principal. But when the government of the United States chooses to indict the principal, and they're big boys and they're supposed to know the law, and in order to have some kind of semblance of uniformity across this country of ours, because each U.S. attorney may act differently and does, if Niederberger was not tried, there would not be a mutual collateral estoppel. There would not be a finding by a jury that he did not, in fact, commit the crime. And that's what happened here.
But they indicted the principal, tried him, and he was innocent.
And he was found not guilty on three counts, Justice. That's correct.
Dunn says he can be found not guilty, and your client can be found guilty.
But, Justice Rehnquist, in every case that is decided, in every circuit that is reported, and interestingly enough, you asked why I didn't comment on U.S. versus Dunn, why didn't the government talk about one case cited on page 9 of my brief where if you try the principal and the aider and abettor.
This isn't the Court of Appeals. This is the Supreme Court of the United States.
I understand that. And in this case, Your Honor, in every case that has been passed upon,
are these United States Supreme Court cases you're referring to?
There are cases in the Supreme Court of the United States where if you try two conspirators, and only two conspirators, and one is found not guilty, there can be no conspiracy. So you really have to get to the nub of whether or not I can also win this case because I think the charge is incorrect, and that's raised on this appeal, in that the judge below, in his charge, said, you don't have to find an agreement. Now, that's why I like to get back to the indictment. What does the indictment say? Stanifer cannot be indicted, as we all know, under 7214A2. It only applies to an employee of the government of the United States. He can only be indicted as an aider and abettor. Now, if we want to look at definitions, we have to look at even Black's Law Dictionary, which says that aiding and abetting, Abbott cited page 15 of my brief, implies knowledge. It comprehends all assistance rendered by words, acts, encouragement, so forth. It is not sufficient that there is a mere negative acquiescence, not in any way made known to the principal malefactor.
Well, in the 8 years I've been sitting here, Black's Law Dictionary has never been thought of as a substitute for the U.S. reports.
Well, it may not, but you see, aiding and abetting, I think, connotes a certain action on the part of an aider and abettor. You can't aid and abet nobody, as Judge Aldersert said in his dissent in the Court of Appeals. And when you do have one who is charged that he did aid and abet Niederberger, and Niederberger must have received a fee, compensation, or reward by reason of official acts to be performed, or performed or to be performed.
Well, it was found in this case that he did.
No, sir. In this case, it was found that he didn't. It was found that Niederberger did not receive a fee, compensation, or reward in counts 1, 3, and 5. He was found not guilty. But even as to the counts in which he was found guilty.
Yes. He found that he aided and abetted somebody doing an unlawful act.
Now, when the aider and abettor goes to trial, Justice White, yes. I suggest to you that they're contrary to the judge's charge to the jury, in which he said, you do not have to find an agreement between Stanifer and Niederberger. It is sufficient if he received as the large case auditor of Gulf
but
Oil.
The jury had to find that the principal committed an illegal act.
And I suggest one
and
thing.
Didn't it? In this case, it had to find that the principal committed an illegal act.
Yes, sir.
And it did.
It found as to all counts, yes.
Yes, and it found that he committed an illegal act and that in certain respects your client aided and abetted. It's true that in another case the principal was found innocent, but in this case the principal was found guilty.
The principal was found guilty at a retrial by the same government. That is correct. But then I get to the next point, Mr. Justice White, and that is that under the instructions, this jury was a very intelligent jury. After 3 hours of deliberation, they sent a note to the court saying, is intent important in any of the 9 counts of this indictment? I suggested to the court that the answer to that was a simple yes. The court then called the jury back and not only said yes, but then proceeded to tell the jury that they did not have to find an agreement between the principal and the aider and abettor. And in fact, all they had to do was find that a gratuity was paid for a speedy audit, of which there was everything but evidence of that. These cases show that the IRS was auditing 1960 returns in 1971. But he said, if you find that it was by reason of a speedy audit or a favorable result, which brings me to the third point of my argument. If you find that it's a favorable result, and I've cited Boland back to show that the last-ditch instructions of a judge to a jury is the one that carries out, and they did come back in about an hour after those instructions, which left them nothing to decide, took complete defense away from the jury. They came back in an hour with a verdict of guilty. Because I wanted to show, in fact did show, that Gulf Oil over the period of these audits had paid $150 million in additional taxes. I showed and could show that in each case, what the IRS did here and the government did here, they did not find a specific act for which these golf trips were taken. They found that an audit had been turned in by the audit team of which Niederberger was a part. Then they went back from there to see if they could relate a golf trip to the audit. And if they took place 2 or 3 months after the audit had been filed, the judge then told the jury that this could be fee compensation or reward.
Well, this is a different argument than whether or not you can convict one as an aider or abettor if the principal has been acquitted.
That is correct, sir. I think.
Are you through arguing that first?
No. I think the fact that a jury has passed upon the innocence of Niederberger precludes, when a judge should be able to take judicial knowledge of that under the rules of evidence, precludes.
You think the government should not have more than one chance to prove the principal guilty? If he's been found innocent, that's the end of it.
I would hope.
And for aiders and abettors, too.
Yes, I'm urging this court to say to the United States of America and its U.S. attorneys, you're no different than any other litigant.
But you don't cite Dunn, which is to the contrary, and you don't urge that in your brief in haec verba.
I urge in my brief, Your Honor, that non-mutual collateral estoppel, Ash versus Swenson and its progeny, should be applied to this situation where the government, and this is where I suggest respectfully to this court, you can say to the U.S. attorneys across the land, do not indict a principal, and then if he is acquitted, come back and unfairly then try on the same facts. It's a narrow issue in this case. It's not the broad case.
Your argument, of course, would be far broader than aiders and abettors. Suppose a statute said it shall be illegal to give or receive a gratuity for performing a governmental act.
And so
you indict under that statute a government service and servant, and he's acquitted. And then you indict the person that is accused of giving him a gratuity, and not as an aider or abettor, but as a principal.
And you
would say that is barred.
I would say, sir, that if the identical facts were presented to a jury in this country and that jury has found against the government of the United States, the government of the United States is barred just like any other litigant.
Your argument is even weaker than Dunn, it seems to me, because Dunn was the same trial. Here you're talking about two separate trials.
But I'm also talking, Justice Rehnquist, about a narrow issue that was not present in Dunn and is not present in all the hypothetical cases that we can conjure up to show why it doesn't apply. For example,
What is the narrow issue that is present in your case that was not present in Dunn?
There can only be one recipient and guilty principal in Standifer, and that is Mr. Niederberger. And it is not a case where you have a suppression of evidence, you don't have entrapment, you don't have a principal who wasn't tried, you don't have all the things that has to be found in order to avoid the fact that in this case, the only named principal who could commit the principal offense was acquitted.
I take it you're just making a statutory construction argument. You wouldn't say it. Would you say that Congress, if it could not under the Constitution expressly provide for convicting the aider and abettor after the principal's acquitted?
If Congress ever passes the new penal code, we'll have to reach the constitutional argument, but it also indicates...
Well, I know, but what's your position? Are you making a statutory construction argument?
Right now I'm making a statutory construction argument because the model penal code and the one now pending before Congress would indicate that its legislative intent when it passed the 1951-1909 aiding and abetting statutes was that an acquitted principal would bar the trial of the aider and abettor.
Neither of these were in effect when your client was tried.
Which, sir?
The two that you're referring to, the model penal code and the revised...
Congress has not yet passed what it is considering, but the fact that you now have legislation pending before Congress indicating that they want to pass a law saying that the acquittal of the principal will not bar the trial of the aider and abettor, in my understanding of statutory construction, would indicate that when Mr. Standifer went to trial and until today, the acquittal of the principal is in fact a bar because they're changing the law.
Well, and they haven't changed the law.
Therefore, having indicated that they would like to do it, sir, I think it indicates congressional intent was to the contrary in 1951 when they passed the aider and abettor amendment.
Except that they're two different Congresses.
Pardon me, sir?
Except that they're two different Congresses.
Well, that's the trouble with looking to legislative intent, and I think, Your Honor, in U.S. versus...
I don't see how you can say that the original jury, all it did was acquit the man. It didn't say the crime wasn't committed, did it?
I disagree with Your Honor.
Did it say the crime wasn't committed?
Yes. I think in this country it has to be that, sir, and I've cited cases...
All it said was acquitted.
No. Justice Marshall, as I understand
the... This man is not guilty.
As I understand
it. Thought that he wasn't properly identified.
No, and it also...
They could have.
They could have found...
They could have thought he was in China when it was committed.
Well, if he were, of course, then he couldn't have been aided and abetted, you see. But the fact is that in this case, they did find that he was not guilty, and I understood that when Mr. Niederberger went to trial, he had the presumption of innocence.
Under what constitutional rule do you say that this young man can't be tried?
The constitutional rule that I would apply is the application of non-mutual collateral estoppel that was discussed in Ash versus Swenson.
Where is that in the Constitution?
I think Justice Stewart went through non-mutual collateral estoppel as a principle established by this court, applicable to criminal cases as well as civil cases.
This Ash against Swenson involved the double jeopardy.
It did, sir.
Being twice put in jeopardy. And this, there's no, you can't, you don't.
There's no double jeopardy in this case. That's why I call it non-mutual collateral estoppel, which is what we're talking about.
Does not your argument mean the inconsistent verdict and the idea of a compromise verdict would be washed out? Isn't it possible that this first jury for Niederberger simply reached a compromise verdict?
Well, of course, anything's possible, Mr. Chief Justice, but I think that...
Isn't that what Justice Holmes had in mind when he wrote in Dunn?
In Dunn, he said that, but it is also... I might cite Benton versus Maryland to your honors in answer to that question, because your honor said, and Justice Harlan then stated, the state has no more interest in compelling petitioner to stand trial again, recognizing that it's double jeopardy, for larceny, of which he had been acquitted, than in retrying any other person declared innocent after an error-free trial. Now, I don't know why the ALI and the majority of the Court of Appeals keep saying that because a man is found not guilty in the American system of justice, that it is somehow a miscarriage of justice, or we have to conjure up. The fact is, Niederberger had a trial. He was the conviction was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. He's presumed innocent. He was acquitted of three charges. I thought in America that meant that he's innocent.
But he was not, he was found guilty of the other charges in the only trial to which he was subjected.
That is correct. And on those other trials, I then get to the argument that I left with. Justice White took me back to the question of the Constitution. And it is a stronger argument, if you will. And that is that if a principal must receive a fee, compensation, or reward, there must necessarily be an agreement between the principal and the aider and abettor who is charged as an aider and abettor in giving him a fee, compensation, or reward. Because if he doesn't give it as a fee, compensation, or reward, and if it isn't received as fee, compensation, or reward, there is no substantive offense committed.
Isn't it possible that he did receive it?
Justice Marshall, what I'm talking about now is a factual issue to be presented to a jury.
Well, wasn't it presented to the jury?
No, sir.
Wasn't
no.
In this case,
absolutely not, because Judge Knox specifically said to this jury, sir, that you do not have to find an agreement between Mr. Stanifer, and I have that covered in my brief. I can point it out, but the fact is that at page 87A of the appendix, Judge Knox charged the jury specifically that it is not necessary to find intent. The question of whether or not the tax returns were correct is irrelevant to their consideration.
But your client was charged as a principal, was he not?
He's charged as a principal, but you still have to have a substantive offense. He can't be charged as a principal without having 7214A2 violated by Niederberger. That's the difference between Dunn and Bryan and the progeny of cases which say if you have an innocent dupe, Stanifer could not be convicted of aiding and abetting an innocent dupe. And that's the difference between U.S. versus Dunn and any other case that is reported.
But in your jury, the jury concluded all the issues against your client, thereby fine.
No, it concluded it the issues.
It returned a verdict of guilty against
but
him.
I respectfully suggest to Your Honor that what I'm saying to you is a jury could only pass upon what a judge charged that they could pass upon. And in this case, the judge took away from them two ingredients that are crucial to the defense. One, there must be an agreement between the principal in this kind of a case who has to receive a fee compensation reward and an aider and abettor who must pay the fee compensation reward. If Niederberger received it differently, or if Stanifer took him on golf trips for different reasons, even though he received it as a fee compensation reward, the intent, after the jury came back and asked about intent, the judge said intent is unimportant. If he did it for any one of a number of reasons without specifying any particular act. So I'm challenging, and I took exception, and you will see I continue to take exception to the charge, where Judge Knox said, you don't need intent. I said, well, what's this malum prohibitum nonsense? All you have now, if you have an IRS agent and you buy him a cup of coffee, you take him to lunch, you take him on a golf trip, you're guilty of a crime. You don't need intent.
Are you saying your client was not properly chargeable as a principal?
I'm saying that the judge did not properly charge him.
That can be answered yes or no.
He was not properly charged as a principal for the three counts of which Niederberger was acquitted. On the others, yes.
Okay.
But in order to have a jury pass upon the facts, the jury must have had an opportunity to recognize that the Bahamas X report in the post-Watergate syndrome we had in this country, Gulf Oil was supposed to have given political contributions through a corporation called Bahamas X. I still say that nice to get back to the beginning. It's the indictment. The indictment in this case, 8 and 9, charges, and again, if we only stick to what I am supposed to be defending, which isn't in the indictment, much of what Your Honors are asking really doesn't have much to do with this indictment.
Except that evidence can come in during the course of a trial, and if it's unobjected to, the indictment need not be formally amended under the rules.
That is correct. But you still have to charge a jury properly, I think, so that they might consider. In Bolenbeck, you see, after going through all of that, this court said the charge on inference at the last-ditch charge of the judge was wrong, so you reversed. And that's where I am. I'm at the point where a judge charged this jury and took my defense away on all counts of the indictment, whether you want us to go to trial on 9 counts or 6 counts. But on every count, I did not have an opportunity, and I've covered the legislative intent on 201F, where Senator Keating has talked about this is not a malum prohibitum statute. He wanted to make it such, and it wasn't passed as such.
Can I ask you one question?
Yes, Justice.
We're all trying to go back to the beginning all the time. With reference to the Dunn against the United States and inconsistent verdicts and that problem,
Would your position be the same if the two cases had been tried as one, had been a joint trial?
Yes, Your Honor, and every case...
You don't rely on the fact that they're successive separate trials?
No, sir. In fact, I have relied on the fact that in joint trials, what I object to is the government being able to pick and choose and have a different result. In the joint trial, every appellate court that has had it, every circuit court that has had it, have said that you must charge a jury in this kind of a case. If you acquit the principal, you must acquit the aider and abettor. Now, why should you let a U.S. attorney try the principal and then come back and say, now we don't apply that principle of law? That is the law in this country, at least up to this point.
Well, you say that if we affirm that it necessarily means that a jury could come out with different results in the same trial between the principal and the aider and abettor. They could acquit the principal and convict the aider and abettor.
That is correct, sir. And up to this point, no court has said that. But I might also say, in connection with the charge...
I'm still puzzled. Why isn't that perfectly permissible under the Dunn case?
Well, in Dunn, as I recall it, Judge, and in all the cases that I have read in connection with inconsistent verdicts, they say, well, one jury could have, for example, the conspiracy cases. If you charge only two named conspirators and one is acquitted, every court has said there's no conspiracy.
What is the leading case for that proposition?
I have it in my brief, and I do have it cited. If I can have a moment, I'll catch it for Your Honor. But the issue... I have the conspiracy cases cited, I believe, Your Honor, on page 36 of my brief, Morrison versus California, which held conspiracy imports a corrupt agreement between not less than two. Now, in those cases where you have only two named conspirators or alleged conspirators, one is found not guilty, Morrison says the other has to go free, and there are lots of lower court cases to that effect. However, if you have the conspiracy between two and other persons
in
known...
California?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Morrison against California?
Morrison versus California, 291 U.S. 82 at 92, Your Honor.
You don't list that in your...
Yes, I do. At page 36 of my brief, Your Honor, I have it.
But you didn't get in your table of citations.
Yes, 291 U.S. 82 at page 92. Hartzell versus United States, 322 U.S. 680. Bates versus United States, 323 U.S. 15, Dictum in U.S. versus Fox, 130 footer, and so forth. I have a myriad of cases which hold that as the principle, and I think you have to say it. To me, it is as logical to say two people must conspire to convict two, and you can't have one, as it is to say that you can't convict an aider and abettor of an innocent principle. And it does not make sense to me that you allow the United States attorneys to pick and choose the time in which one will come to trial or the other will come to trial and say, in one case, if you come to trial together, you must charge the jury that if the principal's acquitted, acquit the aider and abettor. But if I happen to choose as U.S. attorney to try the principal first and then the aider and abettor, a different result obtains, and it doesn't make sense.
Was done a conspiracy
first?
There are cases on that, too, Your Honor. You will see in lower court cases where the aider and abettor is tried first and the verdict against the principal has been reversed. The Court of Appeals has vacated of its own motion the aider and abettor, and I have that cited in my brief, vacated the aider and abettor conviction because they say it's nonsense to allow the principal to go back and maybe be acquitted and the aider and abettor would end up being convicted.
Was Dunn a conspiracy case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't recall. I don't believe so.
I don't believe it was.
I don't believe. But again, the difference between them is there are cases that can be there are crimes that can be committed by innocent dupes. In this case, you cannot have an innocent dupe principal. He must receive a fee compensation or reward for his job. And when we get to the charge in this case, I wanted to show you that under count 8 of the indictment, we are charged with giving Cyril Niederberger a trip. The audit of the 69 and 70 tax returns, and an investigation conducted of Gulf Oil Corporation's political contributions and the submission of an investigative memorandum of March 28, 1974. That's been called the Bahamas X report throughout the proceedings. I wanted to show that the Senate of the United States had a special post-Watergate investigative body with a special prosecutor. I wanted to show that the intelligence branch and the Internal Revenue Service investigated that report. I offered, and the offer is in my brief and cited, to show that the Niederberger report, as submitted March 28, 1978, was an accurate report. The IRS declined criminal prosecution of Gulf Oil. I wanted and did show that Gulf Oil had paid over $150 million in additional taxes for the audits of which Niederberger was the large case manager, every trip of which, the Gulf trip, was taken after the government said the report was filed. So under these facts, you have to go to the fact that the government is trying to prove a reward. Now, if they're trying to prove a reward, why would, or at least can't a jury and shouldn't a jury have the chance to decide if the reports were proper? If Gulf paid $150 million in taxes, couldn't a jury take as a fact that into consideration in deciding the factual issue of whether it is a fee, compensation, or reward, or under 201F, is for or on behalf of any duty performed?
What difference does it make, Mr. Gondelman, whether you're paid in advance, cash on delivery, or 30 or 60 days later, which is the way lawyers and doctors send their bills?
Because in this case, Mr. Chief Justice, the judge said, oh, you mean because the bribe didn't take all through this trial, I wasn't trying a bribe case, you understand, because then it would have been admissible. But his remark to me was, well, if the bribe didn't take, you mean the man isn't guilty. The fact is, in this case, the jury could consider, since the golf trips took place after the report was filed, months after, would an intelligent person offer a fee, compensation, or reward when his company is getting socked with $150 million worth of taxes, or at least, isn't it a jury question? That's the issue. Thank you very much.
Mr. Alsop.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. The basic issue in this case is whether one who aids, abets, counsels, induces, commands, or procures an offense against the United States may be convicted for doing so after the actual perpetrator of the offense is acquitted in a prior suit. In the present case, the evidence clearly showed and the jury found that petitioner, as head of Gulf Oil Corporation's tax division and acting on Gulf's behalf, gave authorized five all-expense-paid vacations to the Internal Revenue Service official in charge of the ongoing audits of Gulf's income tax liability. Although petitioner claimed at trial that these gifts were made out of friendship and for social reasons, the jury found to the contrary, that they had been made and received as fees, compensations, and rewards for the performance of the IRS official's duty, and that accordingly the official violated 26 U.S.C. 7214 in accepting them. In turn, the jury convicted petitioner of the five counts of aiding and abetting the IRS official in the unlawful receipt of those five vacations. There was one count for each vacation. Petitioner challenges three of those counts. Petitioner does not deny the sufficiency of the evidence against him or assert any constitutional infirmity in his convictions. Rather, his basic claim in this case rests entirely on the fact that in a prior trial, the IRS official was acquitted of the charges that he violated Section 7214 in accepting those three vacations. Although I might add that on two of those three vacations, he was convicted of violating 18 U.S.C. 201G, part of the gratuity statute. In turn, petitioner contends that those acquittals on the 7214 counts absolves him of having aided and abetting the unlawful acceptance of those three vacations. In support of this position, we construe petitioner to advance two basic arguments. One, 18 U.S.C. does not authorize the prosecution of the aider and abetter after the actual perpetrator has been acquitted. And two, even if 18 U.S.C. 2, that is the general aiding and abetting statute, does authorize such prosecution, then under the doctrine of non-mutual collateral estoppel, the prior acquittal of Niederberger, the IRS agent, bars petitioner's convictions.
Mr. Alsup, just a matter of curiosity, is that term non-mutual collateral estoppel used once in the other brief, the opposing brief?
I think it actually is. There's one. I believe the substance of the argument is made in the briefs. I'm not sure that term is used.
That the collateral estoppel argument is fairly embraced by the questions presented in the petition for certiorari?
Looking strictly at the questions presented in the petition itself, there's some doubt as to whether or not the collateral estoppel issue itself was raised. However, that doctrine, in fairness to the petitioner, I would say that doctrine is somewhat related to the arguments that were made in the Court of Appeals, in which the Court of Appeals did address.
Well, I take it you're willing to assume it's here anyway.
Well, we're willing to assume that it's here, and we have briefed it on the assumption that this Court would consider deciding it. In our view, both of the arguments, the statutory argument and the argument based on non-mutual collateral estoppel, are unpersuasive. Petitioner's first argument, based on the meaning of 18 U.S.C. 2, is that when Congress enacted the statute in 1909, Congress intended to carry forward an aspect of the common law under which the prior acquittal of the common law principle precluded conviction of the common law accessory before the fact.
Mr. Alsup, can I interrupt and clarify one thing that I'm not sure about? What is the government's position as to what would be the proper disposition if the two cases had been tried together?
If the two cases had been tried together, it would have been absolutely permissible for the jury to reach inconsistent verdicts.
You would rely on Dunn in that situation.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, didn't Dunn just involve one person?
That's correct.
And it was just a question of inconsistent verdicts between two counts.
That's correct.
Didn't involve two people.
But the principle that was announced
in
that
case. Have
you
got any cases in this court that says that sustains an inconsistent verdict?
Well, let me respond on two points.
Were there more than one defendant involved?
Yes, and the Dodderwhite case did involve two different defendants. One was the corporation, and one was the officer of the corporation, and the jury did not convict the corporation. They were hung with respect to the corporation, but they did convict the officer. And the claim that was made was it was inconsistent to convict only the officer and not the corporation, because obviously the officer was simply acting on behalf of the corporation, and this court, citing Dunn, rejected that proposition. Now, the language in Dunn itself is actually much broader than what could be termed the narrow holding of the case, but Justice Holmes did say that there is no need to have consistency in jury verdicts, that is part and parcel of the jury system in this country, is that juries may exercise compassion, they may compromise.
You're just talking about one jury there, and we're talking about two different juries.
Well, but this court extended that reasoning in Dodderwhite.
But the court has never extended the reasoning of Dunn to successive trials, to two different juries.
Well, that's because there never was any thought up until possibly the time of Blundertongue
right.
and Park Lane that the idea of non-mutual collateral estoppel was just unheard of at the time Dodderwhite and Dunn were decided.
That's right. So that the non-mutual collateral estoppel issue is a brand new question this Court has really never addressed in the criminal context.
Right.
One of the questions we have to decide is whether the reasoning that applies in the civil context, and I assume you would agree that there would be non-mutual collateral estoppel here if it were a civil case, does that reasoning apply to a criminal case?
Well, we're not. I agree with your general statement of the issue, and I'm not quite sure we would agree with an aspect of that had these been civil cases, we would necessarily agree that the government would be collaterally estopped.
Well, what possible argument do you have against that?
Well, it would depend. It would depend. You know, in the Park Lane case and in Blundertongue, They were specialized.
Fair opportunity to litigate and same issues and all
but
that.
But more than that, in Blondertongue, the court said this is a patent case. There's special considerations here. There was no law enforcement aspect of the case. Now, if we had a civil case brought by the government where there were some law enforcement aspect of the case, that might inject a new consideration into the calculus that wasn't present in either Park Lane or Blondertongue.
Conspiracy cases. Where you indict Mr. A for conspiring with Mr. B and he's acquitted. And how about trying Mr. B for conspiracy?
Well, our position there, once again, and we think this is sustained by the cases in the court, is that there can be inconsistency there, too.
What if you tried them both in one trial?
Absolutely the same result there. You could convict conspirator A and acquit conspirator B. There's no need to have consistent verdicts in such trial. And that's even true in the case where there are only two named conspirators.
The cases that your colleague relies on, Morrison against California, you don't put much into that.
Well, we distinguished all those in our brief, but let me, I can give you one example. Morrison is perhaps a good example of the infirmity in that reasoning with respect to each of those cases. In the Morrison case, there were two people who allegedly conspired. And the court held that evidence with respect to one of them was based upon an unconstitutional presumption. And then the court looked at the rest of the evidence and said, but there's absolutely nothing else in this record that would support a finding that conspirator number one had entered into any agreement. Therefore, because there was an absolute failure of any proof with respect to the agreement element, the conviction was invalid with respect to both. That case does not hold that where there is sufficient evidence with respect to each element of the conspiracy, that the jury couldn't return inconsistent verdicts. And I think you could go down each of those cases that the petitioner has cited on that point, and every one of them can be reconciled with our point of view. Turning back to the question of statutory intent with respect to 18 U.S.C. 2, perhaps I should just briefly say that the reason that this statute was enacted in the first place involves a perverse rule under the common law that originally came into the common law at a time that the death penalty was the common penalty for felonies, and it was thought there was some procedural protection that was needed to protect against the imposition of the death penalty. The rule worked only with respect to a term known only to the common law, and that was accessories before the fact. Just to contrast it, the rule even at common law with respect to misdemeanors was that everyone who was in any way directly or indirectly responsible for a crime was a principal. There was no such thing as an accessory before the fact for misdemeanors. Moreover, a person who aided in abetting and was present at a crime, that is a felony at common law, also could be charged and convicted irrespective of whether or not any other person was convicted of the crime, and that person was regarded as a principal. Now, the special rule that applied with respect to accessories before the fact was this. An accessory before the fact was someone who was not present at the scene of the crime, but who aided or somehow counseled and assisted in the commission of the offense. That person could not be even prosecuted until the principal was convicted or unless they were charged in the same joint trial. And that was part of this procedural safeguard against the imposition of the death penalty. This had some unfortunate results. For example, if the principal just couldn't be found, then the accessory before the fact, even if they were in custody, could not be brought to justice. Similarly, if the principal were to die, then the principal could never be convicted, therefore the accessory before the fact could not be brought to justice. And more to the point of this case, if the principal were tried and acquitted, that acquittal would forever thereafter bar the conviction of the principal. Therefore, the procedural bar rule couldn't be satisfied, and the accessory before the fact thereafter could not be tried. Now, with the waning of the death penalty, most of the states eventually abolished that distinction altogether. And Congress in 1909 did exactly that in 18 U.S.C. 2, which provided that anyone who aided, abetted, counseled, commanded, induced, or procured an offense against the United States is a principal. Now, by defining principal to include all aiders and abettors, etc., the statute just simply abolished the category of accessories before the fact. And since this category is the very predicate of the petitioner's argument, the 1909 Act also abolished the predicate for the petitioner's argument. Under the Act, petitioner is not an accessory before the fact and is not entitled to any special pleading rules, but is punishable to the same extent as the principal. Turning to the second of the petitioner's arguments, this is an independent argument, and as Justice White has pointed out, it is much broader than the statutory argument based on 18 U.S.C. 2. Petitioner and judge, as did Judge Gibbons below, argues that the conviction of petitioner with respect to the aiding and abetting counts as to those three counts is barred by the doctrine of non-mutual collateral estoppel.
Also, before you get into this argument, I just want to raise one question about it. In our earlier colloquy, we talked about this as a brand new concept with Blonder Tongue and the like. But isn't it correct that the concept of offensive non-mutual collateral estoppel is rather new as those cases, but the concept of defensive non-mutual collateral estoppel is something that's been around quite a while?
Well, since I think 1948, I believe it was the Bernhard versus Bank of America case was the, in the California Supreme Court, not a federal case at all, was the first time that a major court in this country adopted it. I would say 1948 still qualifies as...
As defensive collateral estoppel?
I believe that was defensive in that case.
And that's the first case that applied that?
Well, it's the first major case. It's the leading case. There may have been lower court cases before that. I'm not aware of them.
That was what, 1948?
1948. Now, we contend that non-mutual collateral estoppel is unavailable in the circumstances of this case. Traditionally, collateral estoppel is available only if there is mutuality in the application of the doctrine. That occurs where both parties, in the present case, were parties to the prior case, or at least were in privity with someone who was a party to the prior case. In the present case, the petitioner was not a party to the case in which Mr. Niederberger was acquitted. Therefore, he is not entitled, if the mutuality, under the mutuality requirement, to invoke the benefit.
The same evidence used in both.
Actually, there was overlapping evidence, but actually there was new evidence. This is not a case where it's identical evidence. There was quite a number of different battle lines formed in the second case because new evidence came to light in the interval. So it cannot be said that this was a case in which the jury in Niederberger's case and in Standifer's case had identical evidence before them.
Was there anything shown in the way of a pattern of conduct in terms of Standifer's case?
Well, there was the theory that one of the theories that went to the jury in this case was that each of these five vacations, and these were not just vacations to the local golfing club, but these involved Pebble Beach, Las Vegas, Miami, Absecon, New Jersey, and Pompano Beach, Florida, all at the expense of Gulf Oil Company and lasting on the average of 4 days apiece. Each of these seemed to occur within 1 or 2 months of important events in the ongoing audits of Gulf Oil Corporation's taxes. And Mr. Niederberger was in the position to make all the critical decisions with respect to those audits at that time.
Could there have been an indictment for conspiring to violate the statute between these two men?
That's a question that no one has raised so far, and off the top of my head, I would say yes, but I'm not. There might be problems with that rule. I believe it's called Wharton's rule. I'm just not quite sure whether there could be a conspiracy indictment in this case.
But if there could, you would take the position that one conspirator can be acquitted and the other one convicted.
That's correct.
At separate trials.
That's correct.
Or even at the same trial.
That's correct. The reasons that we think that non-mutual collateral estoppel ought not to be applied to criminal cases are as follows. First of all, unlike the civil case, extension of non-mutual collateral estoppel to criminal cases would frustrate the important overriding interest in prompt and complete enforcement of federal criminal statutes. It would do this in at least two ways. One of the premises of our penal system is that each person who commits a crime will be held individually accountable for the commission of that crime. In a sense, that was the whole point of 18 U.S.C. 2, which was to do away with these procedural bars and to allow each person to be charged as principal. If non-mutual collateral estoppel were introduced into the criminal courts, then when a jury made an erroneous decision, exercising compassion or compromise or whatever, the effect of that erroneous acquittal against the weight of the evidence would be spread to all of the participants charged with a common fact in that crime.
And that you'd have some interesting questions of whether ever to try defendants separately. Or
I'm not quite sure I follow.
Well, the net result of this is that the only time the government could ever convict A, they'd have to convict them all at once or not at all.
Well, or unless they convicted
joint defendants, if they were, if say they indicted 10 people at the same time, they all move for separate trials.
Well, that's right. There could be some horrendous results if number one defendant was acquitted.
Was acquitted, yes.
Then the rest of them, at least if there were a common factual issue, could walk
free.
Well,
if they were all charged with exactly the same crime.
Well, that's correct. Then there might not even be a difficult inquiry on whether or not there was a common factual issue. An example along those lines that might occur would be something like this. Let's say that the government charged a so-called underling with conspiracy and the substantive offense, and the conspiracy alleged that the underling had conspired with, say, someone named Mr. Big, one of the higher-ups in an operation. And the jury exercised compassion against the overwhelming weight of the evidence. The jury decided to compromise, convict on the substantive offense, acquit on the conspiracy. Now, under the petitioner's theory, the government would be forever barred from going after the higher-up.
Because For conspiracy. Well, but that is pretty well the settled rule in the federal courts, isn't it?
Not in this court.
The federal courts.
I don't believe that that's actually even — there are courts, I will say. There are courts of appeals who have held exactly that.
Yeah.
But we would not regard
those — Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit did so when I was a member of it.
That's correct. I won't dispute that. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that that is a settled rule in the courts of appeals. There are courts of appeals who have held that, but this court has certainly never held that.
What worries me is that you are asking us to take into our consideration the possibility that a jury might, quote you, from compassion, turn a man loose. You don't really want us to think that, do you?
Well, Mr. Justice,
don't we take a jury's verdict as it is?
No, we don't. Actually, this court has not handled the problem that way. In Dodderwich and the Dunn case, this very court said and recognized that juries often exercise compassion or compromise or inconsistency, and the court doesn't.
And that we should do something about it.
No, and to the
that's
contrary.
That's what you were saying just a minute ago.
No, I was saying
that because of that, we should allow you to take two bites of the cherry.
No, I'm saying because the court has recognized that kind of compromise.
Well, what about double jeopardy?
Well,
if we find that a jury had compassion, then we give you another trial.
In the case of
you don't need that for your argument. Why
well,
do you
we feel some obligation to make all the arguments we feel have merit, but it's true we don't need that particular argument to win this case. But you know the double jeopardy argument is really not.
The jury could have turned that first man loose because they thought he was in China. That's not compassion.
Well,
they could have turned that jury loose because the government didn't prove its case. They could have turned him loose for 50 different reasons without it being, quote, compassion, end quote.
But, Mr. Justice, would you feel the same way if there was overwhelming proof of guilt at that trial?
I'm not here to answer your question.
Well, our point is that we don't feel that way when there is overwhelming proof of guilt. To us, the logical inference, as this Court has recognized from time to time, is that juries do exercise compassion. Now, you're right. In the Ash case, the Court said we're not going to concern ourselves with the fact that there might be compassion in that passage where the Court talks about we will assume a rational verdict. But that's because the Court was dealing with double jeopardy, and in order to safeguard the constitutional right against successive prosecutions, the Court rightly decided we will not indulge or recognize the fact that juries indulge in compassion. But we're not dealing with double jeopardy here. This is solely a judge-made rule of prudential considerations as to whether or not non-mutual collateral estoppel ought to be applied to criminal cases. And just as the judge-made rule concerning inconsistent verdicts takes that factor into account, the compassion factor, well, so it should be taken into account here. Another reason why the civil cases are different is because in criminal cases, the United States does not have the same full and fair opportunity for factual determinations that are available in civil cases. The root of this problem is a so-called jury nullification, which, again, as the Court has recognized, that goes on in the jury room. But it begins even before that point. There's no discovery in criminal cases. There are privileges that prohibit the government from taking the depositions of the principals to the primary transactions at issue in a trial. There is no directed verdict that the government can ask for when the weight of the evidence is overwhelming. There is no summary judgment motion. And when the jury does exercise compassion, we can't go and ask for a judgment NOV and say set aside that jury verdict, or ask for a new trial because the verdict is against the weight of the evidence, nor can we even appeal the jury's factual determinations. In the Sanabria case, in fact, this Court said, quote, no matter how egregious the error may be, the government just has no recourse against that. Now, that's a big difference between the criminal case and the civil case. And in the criminal case, the government typically does not have the same full and fair opportunity that is available in civil cases.
Mr. Alsop, I don't think you argue, maybe I missed it in your brief, that there might well be situations in which there would be amendments, evidence seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment rights of the first defendant would not be admissible against him, but could nevertheless prove guilt of the second defendant, which makes the two cases quite different in a criminal context. Do you argue that?
Well, we did. We intended to argue, and I think we had a long footnote in which we referred to the Fourth Amendment problem that you just mentioned, and that would mean that, for example, in case number one, certain evidence that is crucial might be excluded, but that would be available to be used in case number two, and that once again is part of the problem that the government faces in having the same full and fair opportunity to litigate an issue that's available in civil cases, because in civil cases, these exclusionary rules just aren't problems, but they are big problems in criminal trials. Now, it's footnote 29, Mr. Justice Stevens, in our brief is where we refer to that problem. I see my time is running out. I will just say briefly that there are other reasons why non-mutual collateral estoppel ought not to be applied in criminal cases. Briefly, one is that the inquiry into determining whether or not the government had a full and fair opportunity and exactly what issue was previously decided might be an exhaustive inquiry in cases. And given the fact that it's the United States who this is really the only one who has an interest here, the United States often takes into account the outcomes of prior trials and is not like an ordinary civil litigant and may not repeat litigation except where in the interest of justice we think it's necessary.
Going back to the type of examples in your footnote 29, why isn't that problem adequately handled by, in the second trial, the government simply advising the trial court that there were these valid objections to its case and that therefore the rule shouldn't apply in this particular case? Why is that a reason for not applying the rule?
Theoretically, you could make an inquiry into exactly what evidence was excluded at the first trial, what evidence wasn't even offered because they knew it would be subject to constitutional problems. For example, in this case, in the Niederberger case, we couldn't even call Standifer as a witness in the first case, and we didn't even try because we knew he would invoke his – so there wasn't any exclusion per se, but it was just not done because of – but you're right. Those factors could all be listed. The judge at the second trial could try to take all those into account. Then the judge could turn to the issue of what was actually decided by the first jury. But don't – our point is that that would be a very exhaustive inquiry in each case. And most of the time, the judge is going to find there wasn't a full and fair opportunity, and it's just not worth the candle to make that inquiry in so many cases where it would undoubtedly be raised repeatedly, simply in the very small number of cases to be able to invoke the doctrine of non-mutual collateral estoppel. If the whole point, or if one of the major points, is to save time of the courts, we think this would waste time of the courts, not actually save it.
If you rely on the inability to call Standifer, that would be a circumstance always present, wouldn't it? You would never be able to call the second defendant as a potential witness in a joint transaction.
Well,
he could always assert his privilege.
That is correct. And that might be a reason why in most cases the judge in the second case would rule in favor of the government.
Well, you'd be able to call him if he were not a defendant. There is a high likelihood he would assert a privilege, but you would not be prohibited from calling him to the stand.
That's right. We could call him to the stand, and although it might be an abuse of prosecutorial discretion to call someone knowing they're going to invoke the privilege.
What case holds that?
Well, I think that's just commonly, in trial courts, commonly understood.
Has it ever been held here?
I don't think so.
Not here, but in some state Supreme Courts that has been held.
Our argument doesn't depend upon whether it would or would not be. It's in many cases, even if the potential defendant would simply invoke the privilege and no evidence would come in at the first trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
May I just give you two?
No, you may leave it.
But I just have two sites to leave for the court. But I just